CGM 99.1 FM programming is hosted almost exclusively by community volunteers. The views and opinions expressed on the following program are that of the host and their guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of CGM FM. For more information and resources, visit our website at cjam.ca.
Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CGM's Handy Link. You're listening to HandyLink on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, Trish Barbato will be telling us a little bit about the Arthritis Society.
So, can you tell me a little bit about the Arthritis Society?
Yeah, so the Arthritis Society of Canada has been around for almost 75 years and has a rich history, really, of being kind of fiery advocates for people that are living with arthritis. And the goal is really ultimately to find a cure, but certainly to find more treatment, to have more innovation, and to support people that are living with the disease.
So, how do you go about reaching out to the affected population?
Well, we try to do that in a variety of ways. We have really good relationships with what I would call is the arthritis ecosystem, which would include rheumatologists who are the specialists, particularly around rheumatoid arthritis. So we have connections with the Canadian Rheumatoid Arthritis Association, BC, Ontario, etc. And then we also have our connection with patient advocacy groups, of which there are a couple in the arthritis area. There are arthritis influencers, so people like Creaky Joints, people who are talking about their personal journey with arthritis. So we use social media, we use our website, we have signature events. So there's a really kind of a big process and that's integrated to try and reach people with arthritis and provide them support.
So, what are some of the common barriers facing somebody living with arthritis?
Well, I think when you think about arthritis, the thing that is most interesting to me, and one of the reasons I took this role as president and CEO, is that people say it's just arthritis. There's a lot of myths about arthritis. People think it's an older person's disease. It's not. Most of the people who have arthritis are under the age of 65. It affects people of all ages, including children. And when you think about the number of types of arthritis, there's over 100. Some of them are almost like rare diseases. They are very, very, very hard to diagnose. And so it's something where it has such a huge impact on the population. There are 6 million Canadians that are living with arthritis right now, but I think that it just doesn't get the stature, it doesn't get the attention in many ways that it deserves.
So, what sorts of specific supports do you provide to the arthritis population?
So we have our arthritis line. So this is a line, telephone and chat and email that is manned by trained volunteers, most of them living with arthritis themselves. And so that is an immediate people can get a response very quickly. They're able to speak to someone. Often we get calls there with diagnosis. People are quite shocked that they might have ankylosing spondylitis or lupus or some other form of arthritis. And so they're just trying to understand the disease better and get access to knowledge and information. That line is also accessed a lot when people are confused about how to access resources within their community. And so we have a really rich database, and we try and connect people to where they can get resources. We also have a very huge evidence-based information in our website. And there you will find all kinds of detailed information around your specific disease diagnosis and the progress that you need to do, all kinds of medications explained to you, references to research and other areas. So I think that that's another big part, is just the amount of information that we have. We also work to, for example, we launched community grant programs this year. We had applications from across the country. These are local, on-the-ground community groups that just needed a bit of money to get their arthritis-related program off the ground. And so we were really happy to award the first set of grants across the country, which was really great. And so that's helping people directly in communities. The big thing we do is fund research. This is another area where I think that there is not enough money right now that is dedicated to arthritis research in Canada. And we support right now at over $5 million a year. And we're the largest non-government supporter of research in the arthritis area. So this spans all kinds of different types of arthritis, different target groups, different areas. We support different areas of the country in terms of research. So that's another one. A really exciting area that we just started last year was working with entrepreneurs. So we did a call out to entrepreneurs in Canada and said, do you have something that could help people with arthritis? And if you do, apply for the Arthritis Ideator Awards. And we granted four $50,000 awards. So there was a kind of Dragon's Den, Shark's Den style night in April. And we had eight finalists. There was a People's Choice Award that had almost 4,000 people vote across the country for it. So those are some of the types of programs and areas that we do to really try and ensure that we're providing support and direct input into the lives of people that are living with arthritis.
So, your time with the Society, what's been the greatest success moment you've experienced?
Well, I think that it's, for me, I haven't been there too long, and I started just before COVID. And you may recall at the time, COVID was really, really hard on charities because we all have a lot of events, and the events are a way for us to bring in fundraising revenue. I think for me, just because of when I started, which was just before the pandemic, and then going through quite a financial crisis with the organization, I would say that from an internal perspective, I'm really happy that we were able to come out of that period much stronger than we were before. So I'm really happy about that. In fact, during COVID, we launched eight new programs. So eight new ways. I mentioned the community grants. I mentioned the Arthritis Ideator Awards. We launched another program called Ignite Research Grants. And these are really interesting. They're more like high-risk, high-reward research grants. These are amounts given to researchers who have an idea who might not be normally funded in the traditional way, but because we're looking at it from an innovation lens, not necessarily deep scientific right away, they don't need preliminary data, etc. It's kind of opened up a whole new opportunity. And so, for example, one of the researchers that got an award is looking at green light therapy or pain management. So things that are just like really interesting and nuanced, and we're really excited about seeing how that follows through.
Like, thank you for taking time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Mm-hmm.
In this segment of our show, Kim Evans will be telling us a little bit about Effect Hope, So, can you tell me a little bit about Effect Hope?
Sure. Effect Hope is a Canadian Christian Global Health Organization. We've been around for more than 130 years, working with people and on behalf of people affected by neglected tropical diseases. We started out working primarily with people with leprosy, and over the past 15 years, we've broadened that out to include people with other neglected tropical diseases as well.
So, when you say neglected tropical diseases, these are the sort of thing that wouldn't be a common household name in terms of what someone would recognize. What are some of the most common ones you run across?
Yeah, so besides leprosy, things like lymphatic filariasis, leishmaniasis, scabies, rabies, snake bite, there's a lot of them. Worms, intestinal worms, just to name a few.
So how do you reach out to the affected community?
Sure. So we go in, we work with partners on the ground, in a local community, since we're invited in. Usually they've identified a problem in the barrier or a gap that needs to be addressed. We would go in and work with the local community. We would do everything from working on prevention and education to support for people who have the disease, so care, cure, those kind of things, to support for people who have disabilities that have resulted from the disease.
So I'm guessing these being lesser known conditions, some places they aren't as able to treat them, that might do some work in places where medical care isn't all it's cracked up to be.
Well, that's true, and there's lots of places these days where medical care is not what it's cracked up to be, but these would be places where there's a very thin medical health system, and that the resources that are directed to medical care are not necessarily being directed to these diseases. So even though they exist in certain regions of the world, they're often some of the most poor countries. So there's just not enough medical dollars to go around. Hence, the diseases and the people who are afflicted with them are neglected.
So how do you overcome some of the myths and stereotypes connected with these diseases?
Lots of conversations, lots of education. We work with the people who are affected because for them, it can feel like they've been cursed or something worse than that. On the other hand, on the community side, we're working with people to get them to understand that these diseases are curable. They're not a curse of God, but rather they're an affliction that with the right meds, with the right medical help and treatment, these folks can live a normal, healthy, and happy life.
So, in your time with Effect Hope, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
Lots of small successes, because every time we diagnose somebody with a neglected tropical disease, we actually can hand them the meds, and they can be healed. The trajectory of the disease will stop right in that moment. Just this past November, I was in India. I happened to meet a gentleman who had been in the leprosy ward when I was there 3 years ago, just before the pandemic. And he recognized me, and he was my driver. I didn't recognize him, and he showed me his hands, and he was like very excited to show me that he's been completely cured. He's had physiotherapy. His hands move just like yours and mine. There may be some residual weakness, but because there's no visible disability, this man is carrying on his life. Just like as if he had never had leprosy. Those are the sweet moments.
So, in terms of leprosy specifically, do you ever find that people think, oh, it's no longer a problem, or, oh, we've made it go away?
Absolutely. I was one of those people before I took this role. So leprosy has been around for thousands of years. It's noted in the Bible. But people in the developed world, we really don't hear much about it. Because our systems and processes, things about sanitation, our healthcare system, make us very unlikely to contract it. In our North American world in particular, if it doesn't affect us, it doesn't really intrigue us, or it doesn't incite us to do something about it.
So,
but it still affects a lot of people, including kids.
So if you could send any message to the community about the need for awareness and to be educated that these conditions do exist and there is hope for them, what would you say?
I'd say do some research. Go online. Check out our website at effecthope.org. Or other organizations for working in the areas of leprosy or other neglected tropical diseases. The World Health Organization has information about the various neglected tropical diseases. Educate yourself. I mean, we in North America, we were simply ignorant, and I was one of those people. And I'm delighted now that I know something, I can be an advocate for people who can't advocate for themselves.
So these things are happening. It's not just what we see outside our own door.
Just because we don't see it out our door doesn't mean it's not happening. That's for sure.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Thank you.
Thank you. HandyLink will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Hey you. Yes you. Thanks for listening to the station. CJM is a nonprofit organization dedicated to our community and you, the listener. We are able to operate because of the funds raised by our communities, but this is often not enough. We are asking for your support, which you could do by contacting our federal member of parliament. Call or write and ask them to support the development of a community broadcasting fund and extend the local journalism initiative. Learn more at ncra.ca/help. That's ncra.ca/help. Thank you once again for your support.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA Windsor on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard a little bit about the Arthritis Society from Trish Barbato, and Kim Evans told us a little bit about Effect Hope. In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Valerie Kraft about Beyond Celiac. So, can you tell me a little bit about Beyond Celiac?
Of course, and thank you so much for having me, Cam. Well, first, to introduce myself, as he said, my name is Valerie Kraft. I am the Director of Community Engagement at Beyond Celiac. So since 2003, we have been the leading patient advocacy and research-driven celiac disease organization. We're working to drive diagnosis, advance research, and accelerate the discovery of new treatments and a cure for celiac disease. Our goal is to help people with celiac disease live and eat without fear.
So tell me a little bit about some of the available treatments for celiac.
So right now, the only available treatment for celiac disease is a lifelong adherence to a strict gluten-free diet. Now, this is different than just taking the bun off the burger or having pick off the croutons off of a salad. This means a gluten-free diet where you have to be careful of cross-contact. And that is when something that has touched gluten or contains gluten comes into contact with a gluten-free ingredient or a gluten-free meal. This means, for example, you can't just go to any restaurant in the world and order something that is made without gluten-containing ingredients. You need to be asking questions about how it's prepared. Are they changing their gloves from touching regular bread to gluten-free bread? Is a gluten-free bun being toasted on the same surface that, you know, the gluten buns are toasted on? Are the fryers, do they have things that have both gluten and not gluten-containing items in them? So this can make adherence to the gluten-free diet extremely burdensome, and it can also be costly because gluten-free products are much more expensive than their gluten-containing counterparts. However, this gluten-free diet is the only way to ensure that that immune system is not seeing gluten as an attack and mounting, however, adherence to the gluten-free diet is the only way to prevent that immune response from happening. Unfortunately, we are seeing that some people are still having celiac disease symptoms, even despite best adherence to the gluten-free diet, or even despite believing that there has been no possible way that they could have gotten what we refer to as gluten. That's why my organization has really put our stake in the ground to find treatments and a cure for celiac disease, to provide other options for our community, not just those that are still continuing to have gluten-free, not just those that are still continuing to have symptoms on the gluten-free diet, but even those that are just looking to have another option that is not so costly and burdensome.
So, what are some of the key barriers facing someone with celiac?
Absolutely. So celiac disease is an autoimmune disease. And when a person with celiac eats gluten, the immune system sees gluten as a threat and it mounts an attack. However, in the process of that attack, it damages the villi of the intestines, which help to digest food and absorb nutrients. In that process, that leads to malnutrition. You're not able to absorb the proper nutrients and can also lead to over 200 different signs and symptoms. You can have anything from very classic gastrointestinal symptoms, such as bloating, gas, diarrhea, to neurological symptoms such as migraines, brain fog, anxiety, to things that you may not even think would be related to gluten, such as rashes on your skin, or really any sort of neurological, psychological effects.
So, go ahead. Oh, sorry. I was just thinking that with all these different symptoms, I'd imagine there's a lot of myths or stereotypes out there concerning celiac.
Yes, so unfortunately, you know, the gluten-free diet has been both helpful and harmful in terms of it being a fad sort of diet. While it has made some manufacturers a bit more eager to make gluten-free products, there is a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of public knowledge of celiac disease as something that is a choice, that it's okay to cheat on your diet, it's okay to just have a little bit, but with celiac disease, that is never the case. Even just eating one crumb or a very small amount of gluten can mount that autoimmune attack. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Please.
I was just going to say it's extremely important that all people with celiac disease maintain that extremely strict gluten-free diet, and there's never any room for the kind of myths of the cheat day or the just one bite doesn't hurt.
So how do you go about reaching out to the patient community?
We have a number of different ways that we reach out and interact with patients. We really try to strive to meet each patient with where they are in terms of their own diagnostic journey and where they are in life. We have tons of resources for our newly diagnosed patients. We have our Getting Started Guide, which is everything you need to know, not just about celiac disease and your diagnosis, but about how to safely maintain the gluten-free diet, how to speak with your family about getting tested because celiac disease is genetic, which means that your first-degree relatives are at a higher risk, and how to manage your life going forward, living happy and healthily with celiac disease. For those that are interested in some more kind of continuing education, we have our virtual town hall series. We do this about every other month, and we partner with some of the best doctors out there that know the most about celiac disease to help educate our patient community on things like the upcoming research that we're doing, as well as questions and answers about their own concerns, about pediatric manifestations of celiac disease, about neurological manifestations of celiac disease. We also have our volunteer and community programs, which are the things that I oversee. We have our ambassador program, which allows some of our most passionate community members to go into their own community to work on a host of different projects and initiatives that meet their passions and to connect with people in their own communities that have celiac disease, and to raise awareness in those communities to make sure that people in that area understand that celiac disease is a serious genetic autoimmune disease and not just a diet that is being done out of choice.
So
we also have... Go ahead.
No, it's all right.
It's all right. So. We have quite a lot of programs. We also have our Go Beyond Celiac database, and this is a really key way that we are able to connect our community with researchers that are working on finding treatments and a cure for celiac disease. This is a portal where people are able to take surveys, explain their own experiences with celiac disease, and researchers are able to use that data, and we are able to use that data as an organization to publish research findings as well as to guide future research directions.
So, in your time with Beyond Celiac, has there been any success moment that stands out for you?
You know, it's funny. I do personally have celiac myself, and I used Beyond Celiac as a resource quite extensively before I joined the team. And I think it's very fascinating to be on both sides and to see what was the success moment for me as a patient and what has been the success moment more broadly as an organization. When I first was diagnosed, I was just starting my college search. And so Beyond Celiac had a gluten-free and college toolkit. And for me, that was the most helpful, shining, guiding light in the darkness resource I could ever imagine, to be able to have a guide that just laid out for me all of the questions I needed to ask, all of the things I needed to consider that I hadn't even thought about because I was still so new to this diagnosis, and just spinning, trying to figure out how I was going to safely eat in a cafeteria 3 meals a day, 7 days a week for 4 years. Now, as an organization, I'm able to look more broadly, and although there are moments that I'm sure everyone in our community has their own greatest success moment with us, broadly, we have done everything from being the first organization to release a public campaign to raise awareness of celiac disease, to this past year alone in 2022, funding over $2 million in research projects for celiac disease, to launching a pre-competitive coalition to accelerate clinical research, to increasing the availability and affordability of gluten-free products, to creating a talk, test, tell campaign to try to get people to test their first-degree relatives for celiac disease and increase some of those undiagnosis rates. We really strive, again, to not only increase the awareness of celiac disease, to increase the diagnosis rate of celiac disease, to fund and continue research into treatments and a cure for celiac disease, but again, to continue to meet our community where they are at every step in the journey.
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Of course.
Thanks. My friends, one of the great dangers in disability life are the myths out there, especially concerning something like celiac. When it comes to a gluten-free diet, yes, there may be health benefits. Yes, in some cases, it may be a lifestyle choice. But in some cases, it's a necessity, something a person needs to live and function at their best. That being said, it's never our place to pass judgment over anything a person might do to support their own needs or the needs of another with a disability. The fact is, they can speak to their condition and their situation better than your everyday observer. But the fact is, this is something they live with. It's a part of their identity. Granted, it's not the entire picture, but by the same token, it's not a hat you take off at night when it gets to be uncomfortable. It's something that you have to learn to understand. That being said, almost any condition can be managed, the situation improved. It's all a question of finding what works for you. And once you do that, you can start taking steps to enrich your life and your contributions in society. This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, We're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.